Good evening, everyone. And what I thought this evening we could do is I could talk for a little while about something that interests me or that I think might be interesting for you or useful. And then we can have some discussion about that or open up for questions or discussion. If you have other questions about meditation or practice that you'd like to talk about, it'd be great to bring it up. And we can see where the discussion goes. And then some maybe 15 minutes before 9 o'clock, we could stop again and have another short sitting. The mindfulness practice that we practice here at the center focuses a lot on the value of attention, on our attention, bringing our attention, being attentive to what's happening. And the background for this practice is that attention, or being attentive to what's happening, is really one of the first principles of Buddhist practice. And there's a lot of implications behind that being kind of a first principle. That each person's practice begins with that person paying attention. Paying attention means noticing what's happening with yourself. And part of the beauty about attention, being attentive, it's a process that happens in the present moment. It's something that, to be attentive generally means you're being attentive to something that's here and now, something that's present right now. So the part of being attentive is to be attentive to what's here. And so the first principle of Buddhism, I'd like to suggest, one of the first principles is that the practice begins with yourself, begins here. And so it's not so much a matter of learning principles from the books or learning ideas or learning from a teacher, for example, some wonderfully inspiring idea of what practice is all about and go home and feel comforted. No, that's great. And maybe someday I'll do that or, you know. But rather, it's really, the first principle is really up to you to pay attention to what's happening right now, here and now with your life. So Buddhism puts a tremendous responsibility on each person's interested in the practice. It's up to you to start paying attention. And if you start being attentive, then what do you discover? What do you discover when you start being attentive? The implication behind this is that there's kind of a trust, inherent trust, in each individual person's capacity to pay attention and to discover, be attentive, and discover what needs to be attended to on their own. So rather than some teacher saying, this is what your experience should be like, the first principle is stopping and just noticing, what is happening here? Being attentive to this experience here. And everybody's going to have a different experience when they sit down. Some years ago, there was a woman who was a member, somehow was a member, maybe on the mailing list, of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin that I'm connected to. And at some point, she sent a letter to Spirit Rock saying, please take me off your mailing list. Please take me off your membership rolls. I no longer want to be part of any connection with you. Because when I come and hear the teachers and practice on the retreats there, people are always telling me what I'm supposed to experience. And I'm not going there to be told what to experience. I'm there to discover what my experience is. And I felt fairly sad by the letter because I felt the person had misunderstood. I don't know. I didn't recognize the name. I don't know if she ever came on retreat with me. But I felt, I've heard a lot of teachers speak, and I hadn't gotten the impression that we're supposed to kind of have certain experiences. But maybe that comes across sometimes. Some people assume that when you practice, you're supposed to become calm. That's a common one. And if you're agitated, then you're not doing it right. Or you're supposed to be kind. If you're angry, then you're something wrong. So you have to hide the fact that you're angry. Or you're supposed to have great insight. You're supposed to see, penetrate deeply into the experience and see something at the core of the very nature of what reality is made up of, what it's all about. Or your psyche, some deep kind of penetrating insight into what makes your psyche work. And it's possible to get calm. It's possible to become kinder. It's possible to have insight. But to set those up as goals can lead a person to not pay attention carefully to who they are right now, what their own experience is right now, what's happening right now. And I'm suggesting that one of the first principles of Buddhism is being attentive to what the experience is right now. So the responsibility for doing that is really up to you. I can't do that for you. Sometimes, someone might say, "Oh, you look kind of, impatient or angry or annoyed." "Oh, yeah, I didn't know that, but I guess I am." So sometimes you can get help. You can get help. And really, to take on the practice is to take on the practice of learning to do that yourself, being attentive to what your experience is. I've known people who have had magic thinking in relationship to meditation practice, where they thought, "Oh, I'll just put in my time on the cushion and something will happen by magic, some wonderful experience, something will happen." And sometimes nice things do happen when we don't do anything but sit there, partly because we unwind. And so some of us are so wound up that it seems wonderful to unwind. But that's not really the point of Buddhism, simply to unwind. One of the real trusts is to begin taking that responsibility to noticing what your experience is. What's happening to you? What's going on? And part of that process is to notice how you then relate to what the experience is right now. And then it gets really interesting. Because what you might find, for example, is that you relate to it with some attitude. It shouldn't be this way, or it should be this way, or this is wrong, or this is right. I'm wrong. They're wrong. Whatever. Or you might have certain kind of interpretations that of the experience. And that's very hard to see sometimes, that the experience is mediated through an interpretation of the experience. And sometimes it takes years and years of paying attention to notice that, oh, it's not really that way. I was interpreting it that way. So it's not necessarily easy to start noticing the relationship we have with the experience. But that's actually, we come to that by beginning to tease apart, by being attentive and teasing apart what's there, noticing what's there carefully. What's here? And the mantra kind of that I had from my teacher in Burma was very simple. A mantra was, "What's this? What's this?" So it's like a mantra you say over and over again, right? So like, "What's this now? What's this now?" And "what's this" meant not what happened 10 seconds ago. You're still ruminating about, "Oh, that great, that wonderful thing that happened, or what was that all about?" Part of the focus on the mindfulness practice is to maintain a continuity of attentiveness to what's actually unfolding in the present moment. And not to kind of be caught up then in what's happened just now and stay behind. The example would be, you go to a river and you get a bucket of water. You're studying the river. You're seeing the river flows and the current and the speed. And you take a bucket of water out of the river and you go around with a bucket and say, "Here's the river." Once you've had the water in the river, or the water in the bucket, it's not really the river anymore. So in the same thing, when we are doing kind of retroactive thinking about the past, retrospective thinking, we're not really attentive anymore to what's happening now. It's useful to think back at things at times, but it's not what meditation is. So there's the experience of what's happening now, and then there's the relationship we have to it, the attitudes we have to it, what we do with that experience. What are you doing with what you notice happening right now? So it's really easy, for example, we have this creaky floor, and so you notice the creaky floor. That's what happens. You're attentive to the fact that you're aware of that creaky floor. Then what's your attitude towards it? Some people maybe are comforted by it. Some people, "Great, I've been coming here for a year and I always hear the creaky floor. It means I'm here, sitting among people. It's great, the association." Some people, "Jesus, what's going on here? It's supposed to be a quiet center and I came as a refuge of quiet and there's this creaky floor and it's creepy and just kind of, I'm just getting into my meditation and suddenly creak. you know, don't they know any better? They're supposed to, you know, they're supposed to protect my concentration here. And so there's all this attitude. Oh, there's some, and then the mind gets in, caught up in this attitude. And you can spend 5-10 minutes, you know, designing a better floor before you remember you're supposed to be meditating. So to notice what the relationship is, it's not just simply a creaking floor, but we get caught in it. We have an attitude, we get ideas about it. And what's fascinating, to go a little bit to Buddhist theory for a moment, not to take you away from your experience, but just maybe to highlight it a little bit, is that all action, and the word for action in Buddhism is karma. And karma, or action that you do, has consequences beyond the physical, mechanical consequences. So if I hit the bell, the consequences, I make a sound. But the karmic consequences are different than the mechanical consequences of an act. The karmic consequences are those consequences, that chain of cause and effect that I set into motion, that are set into motion by the intention behind the action. So if my intention is to ring the bell, is to be educational, that's a good intention. So it's good karma for me. But if my intention is to, you know, irritate you, whatever, that, you know, creates a certain kind of different kind of momentum in the psychic mind, in the mind, the intention. It creates a certain kind of momentum in the mind, which then agitates the mind or irritates the mind, creates bad karma, we say in Buddhism. What's interesting, the point I'm wanted to make here is that in this Buddhist theory, there are three kinds of karma, three types of actions that create this kind of ripple effect in the psyche and the mind. There is physical, there's verbal, talking, and then there's mental. The fact that you're thinking about something, it's only a thought, doesn't free you from the karmic consequences. Thinking is a kind of action in Buddhism. So the way that you think about something also then has consequences in how you're going to feel. So there's the experience of what's happening now, there's the attitude or thought you have about it, and then there's the actions that you have in relationship to it that then shape what the next experience is going to be like. The next moment. So if we have this noisy floor, you hear the noisy floor, that's the immediate experience. The attitude is one of irritation. It's just a simple attitude of irritation. And then there's thoughts around that irritation. Thoughts of anger, of ill will. And because anger and ill will is set in motion in the mind, you kind of like have this filter, we have this filter over our eyes then, over our awareness. So the next moment of experience is going to be colored perhaps through that irritation. So that it might be now that the floor goes, but some car might drive by outside. And we have this predisposition then to be angry or irritated. And so that's part of the next moment's experience. It's not just simply the sound of the car going by, but it's a little bit entangled with the irritation. So we all have that experience, I think, you know, in dramatic, much more dramatic forms where, you know, you've had a trying day and you're irritated and you go home or go someplace and someone says something relatively innocent to you and you lash out at them. Because you bring a certain kind of, you bring something with you into that experience. So there's a present moment experience. There's the attitude, interpretations you have towards it. And it's what you bring along with you into the present moment. Are you following me? So there's three things that are happening in the present moment. There's the what we normally would call the kind of immediate raw experience. There's the relationship you have with that experience that's occurring. And there's the momentum of what you bring with you from the past into the present moment. Those three things are coming together in the present moment. So in learning to be attentive, bringing attention, you can notice all three of those things. You can notice what's the present moment experience, what's the ideas, the attitudes, the beliefs, the interpretations, and what is it that I'm bringing with me? What's my mood? What's the attitude? What's the underlying attitude? What's the underlying mood? And as we get more and more attentive, especially if you can get very calm, there is value in being calm, we might notice some of the deep, deep underlying and pervasive attitudes that we're always carrying with us. Some people, for example, are always carrying with them, they say it this way, it's fairly common on retreats where people are paying attention all the time, in a much higher degree than they do in normal life, for certain individuals to come and say, I had no idea how pervasively I'm afraid. Fear characterizes my state of my mind all the time. I had no idea. And it's kind of like a shock. Or some people, how pervasive, my judging mind is. I'm always judging myself or others. I can't believe it. And on a retreat, it's just so painful because you notice all the time. In daily life, you get distracted all the time from yourself. You don't notice as much. People tend not to notice in the same kind of way their underlying good dispositions. If someone's kind of has an underlying tendency to be kind, it's actually harder for people to notice that. We don't give ourselves that kind of credit so often. We tend to be much more attentive to underlying tendencies towards anger or fear or something that's painful. But the underlying tendencies we have to being kind or compassionate or generous, we're not so disposed to kind of recognize it in ourselves. But it's there also, and some people have it more than others. So perhaps I've already said too much, because there's a teaching in Buddhism, if you tell people too much, then they'll be looking for what you told them to. And if you're looking for what you told them to look for, then they're not going to notice what their own experience is. So the emphasis tonight, what I want to make, is that it's really simple. The beginning point of practice, is your experience. When you first sit down to meditate, when you first start to pay attention, what's your experience? And then one of the things you want to be very careful with is things like any kind of judgment is, this is not the right experience to have. I remember a couple of years ago I was doing walking meditation, and I was walking, doing my walking meditation, and after a while I noticed it was kind of like, I felt a little bit oppressed by the walking meditation. I felt kind of a little bit off, like I was pushing. And I realized when I paid attention to that pushing was that I wasn't simply paying attention to my experience as I was doing walking meditation. I had this subtle idea that I was supposed to get concentrated. I was supposed to get to a different kind of way of being. I was supposed to be a different kind of Gil, a concentrated Gil, when I was doing walking meditation. So I was kind of like pushing myself to get concentrated. And it was kind of like, felt like a burden. And when I noticed it, then I let go of it. And then I simply was there present for what was actually going on for me. And it was much more pleasant at that particular moment to be present for how I was than it was to try to change how I was. So we notice what's happening, and they have to be very attentive to, do we judge it? Do we push it away? Do we defend against it? Do we argue with it? Do we, what do we do with it that makes it more difficult for us, that brings us stress, that brings us suffering? The quest, in a sense, is to see how simple you can become around the experience you're being aware of. Can you free yourselves from interpretations? Can you free yourselves from attitude? Can you free yourselves from getting karmically involved with that experience so you don't make more karma? One of the definitions of someone who's enlightened, fully enlightened, is they no longer create any karma for them in the way that they're involved in the world. They still do all kinds of things in the world, and they're still mechanical cause and effect. But the way in which they act in the world, the way in they respond to the world, there's a kind of a peaceful stillness, perhaps, in the psyche. I'm not fully enlightened, so I can't speak for them. But there's something that they say, that they no longer are making karma with the way in which they respond and act in the world. There's no traces left. There's no wind drag. There's no there's a simplicity in their actions. There's nothing that's left over. Some people talk about they burn themselves up in the moment, and there's no carryover into the next moment. So, in a sense, one of the goals is to become very simple with the experience that you're having of the present moment. And it can be very, very peaceful when you have that simplicity. But when you hear that, then you think, oh, I'm supposed to become simple. And then you overlook the fact of how what your experience is right now. And I really want to encourage you is to start with where you're at and be content that the whole Buddhist path will unfold for you in your own way, the way it's supposed to unfold for you, if you are very honest about what your experience is. Uncompromising honesty about what's actually happening for you moment by moment, without measuring yourself against what it should be or what it shouldn't be or what you think it's all about, or just uncompromising honesty, what's happening now. So it's really then about you, or say it's really about your attentiveness and being honest with what you attend to, what you notice. It doesn't have to be limited just to your own personal experience, but just also what's around you in the present moment, to be attentive to that. And to be honest, at least to yourself, about what you see around you. Today I was with a friend of mine, and for some reason, I'm not sure why, maybe I didn't eat very well today. Middle of the day, I wasn't feeling very well. I started getting a headache, felt a little bit nauseous. And so I certainly noticed it. And then my kind of initial idea was, I shouldn't admit this to my friend. It was a little bit embarrassing, you know. Somehow I felt like I shouldn't tell him. And I should somehow be cheery and energetic and vital and have to be engaged in conversation. But I certainly didn't feel like it. And there was longer gaps in the conversation. So after a while, I just told him, I don't feel good. And as soon as I said how I was feeling, was honest about it, then I wasn't being burdened anymore about having to somehow be different than who I was and some strange idea I had in my mind. That the honesty of saying it out loud freed me from, made me a lot lighter. Saying what's there is a way of becoming lighter. More often than not. So I probably talked long enough. I don't know if this has been useful. I think you got the point. The point is, don't look outside yourself. So what are your thoughts? What are your comments, reactions? Or anything else you want to ask about to practice meditation? Anything on your mind? Anything when you pay attention to yourself, what do you notice that you'd like to discuss? Yeah.
I was just thinking about, you talk about the three phases of the experience. And then there's almost like the fourth one, which is how we then project that outwards to other people, which also can get confusing and damaging and destructive and, or healthy and beautiful as well, whichever way you go with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a version of the interpretation. There's experience and there's interpretation of the experience. And so when it's, we talk about projection now. When we interpret the other person is that way. And so we project our ideas, our interpretations, our attitudes, our history, on that person. And then we do the same thing to ourselves. We project ideas onto ourselves of who we are. And we have all these attitudes towards ourselves. And part of hopefully what mindfulness does is to begin to wake us up to that process. And so that takes paying attention. It can be very helpful to get calm. A mind that's very, very calm can see the movements of the mind as they're occurring much more clearly So it's like, you know, if you have a surface of a pond of water or a lake, and there's a lot of strong wind and a lot of agitation, a lot of waves, and you take a pebble and you throw the pebble into the water, you don't notice that the pebble makes any further waves because there's so many big waves already. But if the pond gets really, really still and you throw a pebble into it, then you see the ripples of the effect of that particular pebble. And so the same thing with your mind. If the mind is really calm, then you can notice this person walks in through the door. You notice the person arising, coming through the door, and you notice there arises in the mind the idea, that person is dangerous. That person is the person I'm going to marry, or that person is, whatever you have, something arises. And if mind is calm, you can catch and see that arising. And then you can take responsibility for it. But if see through it. But if the mind is agitated and busy, there's so much going on, you're not going to notice that particular thought. It's just the thought that arises, that person's dangerous. The initial thought is lost. You don't even notice the initial thought. And already then you're making plans about how to protect yourself or how to propose or how to whatever you think about that person. Did that respond to you? So it's very helpful to get calm sometimes. In order for this process to unfold well. But then don't set up calm as being, as a way of... Don't try to get calm as a way of not being honest about what's happening now. One way to check, kind of a check and balance system for projection is without gossiping, tell it to someone. This person came and I thought this of that person. Or tell the person directly. And then, is that true? And let hear what they have to say. Sometimes I do it, with my wife. I tell, I've met this person today and I always had this thought about this person. And she'll say, I think you're interpreting. You don't really know. You don't really know what people are like. Just from, a simple conversation. And then I often have the experience of spending a lot of time with someone and say, wow, I had no idea the person was like that. There was an experience I had many years ago that was kind of chastising the right word. It was very sobering to me and kind of a wake-up call. Two that happened around the same time, I'm remembering now. The first was, I'd read the book by Stephen Levine called Who Dies. I was very inspired by it. And then I went to a Stephen Levine workshop, weekend workshop on death and dying in Marin County. And so I was there and all these people showed up for the workshop. And they look like what can I say without projecting something on them? But that was the problem. I projected it. These are just regular, ordinary. I don't say. These are just ordinary kind of people. Whatever that means. And then the workshop began. It was a workshop on death and dying. And people started speaking who were there. And people started talking about their grief and. Who had just died and their child had just drowned or, they were diagnosed with a terminal illness and they were about to die. They had to be given, a month left. And there were all these amazing stories. And I was just shocked. These are people, ordinary. I could have passed them on the street and I wouldn't have thought anything about them. And they had this huge, suffering in their life that had been invisible to me until they started speaking. And I realized how much I didn't know people. I kind of projected normalcy on people, whatever that is. And then a little bit later, I was working at this restaurant. I was a cook. And my shift had ended, and next shift was starting. And so I was in the changing room. And this guy came for the next shift, and he as he came through the door, we were friends, and it was kind enough, my expression. I was kind with him and nice and friendly and warm, but it was kind of like I was kind of joking with him when he came. The first thing, he came through the door and I was immediately starting to joke with him. And his best friend had just died. Not that morning, but he just died, like maybe yesterday, the day before or something. And I felt so bad that I hadn't taken the time to somehow get a sense of who this person was before I kind of imposed my automatic kind of silly response to kind of seeing him. So those two experiences were very powerful for me that, you know, maybe I should stop and look more carefully at people, not assume that I know who they are just, you know, from first appearances, and just really, you know, be more careful. And what I've come to really believe is that everybody deserves our careful attention. Everybody, you know, is much deeper and more profound and more, you know, more profound than what I first think about when I first meet them, my first impressions in terms of projection, you know. So what I project now into people is, oh, I think I should get to know this person better. It's worth getting to know this person better. Yeah, please.
So I was wondering, what do you do with the feelings and emotions that arise during the meditation sitting, but that survive and linger on after the sitting? And somehow those get stirred up more because, you know, you've been sitting quietly.
They start up more, meaning that after you get up from sitting?
Yeah, like you may not have been thinking about those things, but just because you've been sitting quietly and your mind is somewhat calm.
Can you give me...
They survive on.
Can you give me more a concrete example?
Say if you realize that you've been afraid and that's like your guiding force in your life, but that becomes more apparent because you've been sitting for a while.
Yeah.
And then that kind of overwhelms you after you're sitting.
Well, the first thing you should do, I mean, a little bit, is be very careful that you don't judge yourself negatively for having discovered you're this way. If you can, in some way, kind of appreciate the fact, this is great. Wow, this is great. I discovered how afraid I am. Wow. It's much better to know than to go around not knowing. So it's a great, you know, it's a really good, you know, feel encouraged by it. And then it really depends, you know, on how powerful it is in your life. Some things can be dealt with through meditation, a regular meditation practice. Some things you can get a handle on. You can in a sense be free of it, that free from it without being free of it, so that you see something like fear arises, and because you see it so well, you've learned how to identify it and how to keep doing what you need to do without having get in the way. If it's really a problem in your life, then finding something more dramatic way of dealing with it. Someone who wants to deal with things through meditation might want to go on a long retreat. A long retreat is a place where there can be enough concentrated stillness and insight and awareness that sometimes you can get deep down into the roots, the kind of the root of what stimulates it, you know, the cause of it in a sense. Sometimes it's more effective to do therapy, for example, if some ongoing chronic issues you notice it over and over again, and it really has, you know, grips you and kind of affects you in ways that are not very healthy. Sometimes spending a little bit of time with a therapist can be very helpful. And someone who's trained professionally to deal with some of these kind of emotional issues. Is that satisfying, or ask more? I'm not very satisfied with my answer. So, if you ask you know, more questions about it, then I would perhaps have something more useful to say. Is it good enough?
Yeah.
Can't satisfy everyone. It satisfies him, but not me. I wonder why he didn't satisfy me. Yeah.
Well, perhaps a question that always I know that there's a goal in banishing duality. And yet we have to sit on both sides of the fence, really, to notice what's happening in us and say, oh, I have a mind filled with greed. But it's not enough to simply notice on some level that I have a mind full of greed. We're told there's a way of dealing with this greed, to substitute something, to give something away, to think of dana, to practice dana. And so we're always balancing this kind of noticing what's there, but not merely being content to let it rest, but to say, is this a useful thing, is it a fruitful thing? If it's not, to try to work through it.
Great, great.
And so we have to sit on both sides of the fence at the same time.
I don't know if it's the same time, but go ahead.
This is my question here, though. Perhaps that's why it's not satisfying, because you know we notice something, we carry it with us away from the meditation. We have to act upon it somehow. Uh-huh. We have to process it in some
great.
Way.
Yeah.
We don't want to just let it process us. Not always. Uh-huh. Say if we have a mind filled with greed, have to process us.
Great. Great. That was very articulate. I like that. So we notice what's going on. We notice what's happening. And the next question is, what do we do with that information? What do we do with what we've noticed? For tonight's talk, mostly I was emphasizing just pay more careful attention. Again, stay with attention, be more attentive, keep discovering what's there. But Buddhism offers a lot of other tools of things that you can do besides just bring attention to your experience. It's very powerful. It can be very, very powerful to not do anything with your experience except hold it in non-reactive, non-evaluative attention. You're not going to evaluate the experience, good or bad. You're not going to react to the experience for or against it. You're simply going to learn how to hold it in a spacious mind. And just let it do that. That's very, very powerful. If you do that, you're not caught by it. Because you're, in a sense, independent of it because you're holding it in a spacious mind. If you're caught by it, if you somehow got, you know, if you're for and against it, then you've been caught by it or it's caught you. So the Vipassana, this meditation that we focus on mostly here at our center, emphasizes this non-reactive awareness. Just keep coming back to the non-reactive awareness of what's going on. But there are many other, in Buddhism at least, and in other places, a lot of other ways of responding. It's one strategy that's very useful. But it's not the only thing you're allowed to do. I've noticed a few people who've spent a lot of years in this particular tradition, this insight meditation tradition, somehow I got the message that the only thing they're allowed to do is with what arises in their experience is to practice non-reactive awareness to it, accept it in some way. And, you know, that was kind of sad that they kind of thought that's all they're allowed to do. It's a pretty limited thing to do. So there's a whole repertoire of other things you can do. And so you have to decide, you know, what do you want to do? You might decide what you're going to do is to do nothing or just to do this non-reactive awareness thing. Or you might just try to bring antidotes. So there's a lot of antidotes. For example, antidote to fear could be a very classic one is cultivating loving kindness, and really cultivate that. And not only is it an antidote that balances it out, but it tends to recondition or heal that part of the psyche that somehow that is producing the fear. And so it's very helpful to kind of shower the psyche with loving kindness. It's kind of like filling yourself with this wonderful warmth of love, and that you know, as the warmth of love kind of begins to soften some of the places where we're afraid in some deep way. That's one way. There's also other practices. For example, Lewis mentioned of generosity. Practicing generosity builds certain kind of strength in the psyche that then can be very helpful in places we're afraid. Or cultivating virtue, becoming a virtuous person, living by the precepts, is another kind of antidote, not exactly an antidote to fear, but kind of an antidote to fear in the sense that, at least classically it's said, that as you live a virtuous life, you'll have less and less reasons to be afraid. And so that helps. You can go into an assembly of people, and not be afraid because you know your behavior has been virtuous. It doesn't work so well in the West because we don't have to have done anything to feel like we're somehow wrong. Many of us Western, you know, many, I don't know, sorry. There are people here who are not, maybe didn't grow up here in the West, so I don't want to kind of say things that assume that everyone here is a particular way. I apologize for that if that was came across that way. But I've noticed among a lot of these Caucasian types who grew up in Western society, or now I'm putting my foot in my mouth, ain't I? I've noticed among people who've been conditioned by Western culture, wherever their conditioning came from, that sometimes they feel like there's somehow something's wrong with them before they've even done anything. And the assumption in the ancient texts, at least in Buddhism, is that the person wouldn't feel that there's something wrong with them unless they had done something wrong. So maybe it's the idea in the West of original sin. We're born this way. And you know the great story about when the psychologist talked to the Dalai Lama about what was the word? Was it self-loathing or self-hate or something? You know the story? It's a great story. It told a lot, so I apologize if you've heard it many times. But there was a psychologist that came to was interviewing the Dalai Lama or asking a question in a large hall of people, and asked the question to the Buddha something about it was maybe low self-esteem or self-hate or something. You know, what do you do about self-hate? And Dalai Lama speaks some English, but the translator translated the question. There was this long back and forth, translator. They were talking in Tibetan, back and forth. No one knew why, what they were talking about. It was a simple question, what do you do about self-hate? And then at some point, Dalai Lama apparently got the question, and he started crying. And what had happened was that he had no concept of self-hate in his vocabulary. It was like a foreign idea to him. And he got it from the translator. This was an epidemic problem in the West. And so he started crying. He was so shocked to realize this was the case. I don't know why I'm saying this. How did I get off on this tangent?
The fact that we don't have to act in a way that isn't virtuous to feel no fear from our surroundings.
Yeah.
In this culture.
And that's one thing I was saying. And yeah, and try to do some retrospective thinking here, back to what I was saying earlier. So what you pointed out, there are things you can do. So for example, there's a whole slew of practices that Buddhism offers that develops the inner strength. And so if you have fear, for example, it might not simply matter resolving the fear, but also maybe developing inner strength that becomes stronger than the fear. And that's one of the things. So one of the common things you see one way of doing that, for example, is cultivating concentration. And one way of working with fear is to not do mindfulness practice for a while, but to do concentration practice. And so the concentration develops the mind so that the mind becomes stronger than the pull of the fear. So you have there's a gravitational force of the fear, in a sense. But if you can have a greater gravitational force of being able to get concentrated, then the mind's going to go towards a concentrated, calm state rather than going off in agitated fear state. So by cultivating concentration, and there are meditators who then notice their fear, and the response to the fear is they just do a concentration practice, like concentrating on their breath, until their mind has become free of the fear because they've concentrated it. And it's also very healing, like loving kindness. It's very healing to have a concentrated state. Very concentrated state is very healing experience because it's a psyche which has become unified, it's become harmonized. And the various ways in which the psyche can be fragmented and fractured and scarred, at least temporarily, get healed. Or you have this wonderful sense of well-being that reconditions the conditioning of that, you know, that we have from being scarred by life in some way. So some people use concentration as a way. Is this better, Mike? But the point I was trying to make in the talk part of it tonight is you want to be very careful if you do anything like an antidotal practice, or if you, you know, cultivate concentration in order so you not be afraid. Be very careful about what the intention is of why you do that. Because it's very easy to have aversion to your experience, try to get away from it. And then the aversion creates bad karma, creates bad habits in the mind. So I'd encourage you, before you do anything with your experience, try to change yourself in any way. Because our Buddhist practice is where you change yourself. Hang out for a while with the practice I'm encouraging you to do, which is just be attentive to what's going on. Just be really attentive, be really honest. What's happening now? What's happening now? If you do that really well, that also is freeing. Yeah?
I have a question about momentum you described, even if this moment for our attitudes and our expectation. So if we go upstream in time. If we go upstream in time,
yeah,
before we're projecting that into this moment, what is our relationship to those things or attitudes that cause us to hold on to them? And how can we take responsibility for that?
I mean, what are the take responsibility for the underlying attitudes we're carrying with us into the future? The interplay. I mean,
with our experiences upstream, what is the process
that carries them along?
Mm-hmm, that causes us to bring them with us.
What do you think?
Some sort of attachment.
Some sort of attachment?
Mm-hmm. Or discontent.
Some kind of attachment or discontent. But you know, one of the things you can bring upstream to the future, the next moment also, is kindness. You can have a predisposition towards kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And is that an attachment? Is that discontent? You can have a predisposition to compassion or to generosity that you carry with you. The certainly, discontent is a very powerful thing that carries a lot with it. It's like a magnet for all kinds of attitudes. An attachment, you know, carries a lot. You know, it's phenomenal how deep attachment works in our psyche. You know, it works at a gross level in our body. You can feel, you know, if you're attached to something, you know, your shoulders get tight, or your stomach gets tight, or your jaws clench or something. Because of the holding, it can be physical. But then the holding also can be very mental. You know, if you've ever had something that you've obsessed about, and you just can't get rid of the obsession. You know, someone's wronged you, for example, and you're really angry, and you just can't. Or you're worried about something, you just can't get rid of the worry. You're just kind of obsessing. So the mind's attached. It's holding on. It's clinging to it. But then it gets, you know, as the mind gets quieter, you see, surprisingly, the subtler and subtler things that your mind is still holding on to. So like one of the things we carry with us into the future is a very, very subtle. Subtle doesn't mean that it's not powerful, but it's lightweight or kind of meaningless, but very, very kind of hidden, quiet attachment to who we think we are, or who we want to be, how we want to represent ourselves, our identity. And people can go through a whole lifetime without ever noticing that they're attached to having a certain identity. And they can notice a lot of other things about themselves. But sometimes it takes, you know, really getting quiet, really getting very, very attentive, listening very deeply to the inner voices in the psyche to see, oh, you know, I'm attached to being a kind person. So, you know, always, being attached means you're not necessarily always kind, but you're carrying that with you as an image. You're trying to fulfill that. You're trying to hold that. Or, I'm X, you know. And so we're always carrying that with us. And wherever we go, some idea of who I am is with me. And then that's a filter through which I process my experience. So am I being kind enough right now? What would be the kind thing to do here? Or, you know, are people noticing that I'm kind? And, you know, how are people, you know, even the concern, the attachment, the concern about how are people seeing me right now? You know, how are people interpreting me? How are people, am I being liked? When I was in the monastery, I was in the kitchen. I was a kitchen manager. And it was a pressure cooker of a lot of people working together in a small space in the monastery. Monasteries can be pressure cookers, psychic pressure cookers. And I told someone once that they had to cut the cucumbers a little bit smaller. And she started crying because it was such, you know, in the monastery, everything's so important. And I learned painfully that how much I wanted people to like me. And because I was a manager of the crew and I had to tell people, like, you know, please cut those cucumbers a little bit smaller. And then they'd get angry with me or they'd cry and they'd think I was, you know, horrible. And so I was always trying to figure out how to say things and do things and so people would like me. That wasn't like what I brought with me all the time. But because it was such an intense place, the cost of that was too great. And so I saw the cost of doing that. I just couldn't do it anymore. I had to give it up. But if I hadn't been in that pressure cooker situation, it would have been a lot harder for me to have seen the cost. Because I'd been doing it for years before that. But I hadn't seen the cost of it. It was kind of invisible to me that I was doing it. Always trying to be liked. So we carry things with us, that are, you know, we don't notice. Yeah.
How did you discover the cost of it?
I was neurotically trying to do it all the time. I mean, the kitchen was a very intense place. I had a crew of 7 people under me. There was a lot of pressure to get things done quickly because meals had to be on time and a lot of work to be done. And I had to go around telling people what to do all the time, all day long. And when you're telling people to do, when you're the boss, you know, people don't, you know, if you tell them they're not doing it right or tell them to do it quicker or tell them whatever, you know, that I want you to do the soup today and not make the bread, and they wanted to do the bread, then you're not a nice guy anymore. You know. So there's lots of, you know, so it was like constant, you know, this thing, you know, because I was telling people what to do. So, you know, I was very lucky to be in this very unfortunate circumstance. So is this at all addresses your vaguely? Yes?
If I'm feeling sleepy, how do I pay more attention to feeling sleepy?
You do the best you can.
What do I look for?
Physically. What does it feel like physically? What does it feel like in your eyes? What does it feel like in your shoulders and your face? What's the temperature differences? So physically you can do things like that. You can also notice something about the quality of your mind. Is your mind slowed down? Is it cloudy? Is it you're getting vague images, dreamlike images of what's happening? What's going on? You know, you can notice, you can actually notice. And sometimes when people pay very careful attention to the experience of sleepiness in meditation, they'll wake up because they're interested in something. It's fascinating. And sometimes you pay attention the best you can, you fall asleep. That's okay. At some point you'll wake up. Or you'll notice how sleepy you are and you say, I think there's a better way. Maybe I'll just do standing meditation. Or maybe I'll do a walking meditation for a while. Or maybe I'll open my eyes. Maybe I'll sit up straighter. So sometimes you might do something to bring more energy back into the system. So I talked longer than... So we have 5 minutes for our short sitting. But I think it's nice to end with a little quiet. One of the beautiful things about learning to be attentive is that when you learn to do it well, it's a very kind thing to do. Attention and kindness, attentiveness and kindness are maybe closely related. May you all discover the refreshing kindness in your ability to be attentive. Thank you very much.